Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Relativity, a Very Short Introduction, by Russell Stannard, narrated by Nick Sullivan.
Preface. All of us grow up with certain basic ideas concerning space, time, and matter. These include: we all inhabit the same three-dimensional space. Time passes equally quickly for everyone. Two events occur either simultaneously or one before the other. Given enough power, there is no limit to how fast one can travel. Matter can be neither created nor destroyed. The angles of a triangle add up to 180 degrees. The circumference of a circle is 2 pi multiplied by the radius. In a vacuum, light always travels in straight lines. Such notions appear to be little more than common sense, but be warned. Common sense consists of those layers of prejudice laid down in the mind before the age of 18. Albert Einstein. In fact, Einstein's theory of relativity challenges all the above statements. There are circumstances in which each of them can be shown to be false. Startling as such findings are, it is not difficult to retrace Einstein's thinking. In this book, we shall see how, starting from well-known everyday observations coupled with the results of certain experiments, we can logically work our way to these conclusions. From time to time, a little mathematics will be introduced, but nothing beyond the use of square roots and Pythagoras' theorem. The theory is divided into two parts: the special theory of relativity, formulated in 1905, and the general theory of relativity, which appeared in 1916. The former deals with the effects on space and time of uniform motion. The latter includes the additional effects of acceleration and of gravity. The former is a special case of the all-embracing general theory. It is with this special case that we begin. Part 1. Special Relativity. The Principle of Relativity and the Speed of Light. Imagine you are in a train carriage waiting at a station. Out of the window you see a second train standing alongside yours. The whistle blows, and at last you are on your way. You glide smoothly past the other train. Its last carriage disappears from view, allowing you to see the station also disappearing into the distance as it is left behind. Except that the station is not disappearing, it is just sitting there going nowhere, just as you are sitting in the train going nowhere. It dawns on you that you weren't moving at all. It was the other train which moved off. A simple observation. We all get fooled this way at some time or other. The truth is that you cannot tell whether you are really on the move or not. At least, not if we are talking about steady uniform motion in a straight line. Normally, when traveling by car, say, you do know that you are moving. Even if you have your eyes shut, you can feel pushed around as the car goes round corners, goes over bumps, speeds up, or slows down suddenly. But in an aircraft cruising steadily, apart from the engine noise and the slight vibrations, you would have no way of telling that you were moving. Life carries on inside the plane exactly as it would if it were stationary on the ground. We say the plane provides an inertial frame of reference. By this we mean Newton's law of inertia applies, namely, when viewed from this reference frame, an object will neither change its speed nor direction unless acted upon by an unbalanced force. A glass of water on the tray table in front of you, for example, remains stationary until you move it with your hand. But what if you look out of the aircraft window and see the Earth passing by underneath? Does that not tell you that the plane is moving? Not really. After all, the Earth is not stationary. It is moving in orbit about the Sun, The Sun itself is orbiting the center of the Milky Way galaxy, and the Milky Way galaxy is moving about within a cluster of similar galaxies. All we can say is that these movements are all relative. The plane moves relative to the Earth. The Earth moves relative to the plane. There is no way of deciding who is really stationary. Anyone moving uniformly with respect to another at rest is entitled to consider himself to be at rest and the other person moving. This is because the laws of nature, the rules governing all that goes on, are the same for everyone in uniform steady motion, that is to say, everyone in an inertial frame of reference. This is the principle of relativity. And no, it was not Einstein who discovered this principle. It goes back to Galileo. That being so, why has the word relativity become associated with Einstein's name? What Einstein noticed was that amongst the laws of nature were Maxwell's laws of electromagnetism. According to Maxwell, light is a form of electromagnetic radiation. As such, it becomes possible, from a knowledge of the strengths of electric and magnetic forces, to calculate the speed of light, c, in a vacuum. The fact that light has a speed is not immediately obvious. When you go into a darkened room and switch on a lamp, the light appears to be everywhere, ceilings, walls, and floor, instantly. But it is not so. It takes time for the light to travel from the light bulb to its destination. Not much time. It's too fast to see the delay with the naked eye. According to this law of nature, the speed of light in a vacuum, c, works out to be 299,792.458 kilometers per second, or very slightly different in air. And that's what the speed is measured to be. What if the source of light is moving? One might, for example, expect light to behave like a shell being fired from a passing warship, where an observer on the seashore would expect the speed of the ship to be added to the shell's muzzle speed if being fired in the forward direction, and subtracted if being fired to the rear. The behavior of light in this regard was checked at the CERN, or CERN, laboratory in Geneva in 1964, using tiny subatomic particles called neutral pions. The pions, traveling at 0.99975 c, decayed with the emission of two light pulses. Both pulses were found to have the usual speed of light, c, to within the measurement accuracy of 0.1%. So the speed of light does not depend on the speed of the source. It also does not depend on whether the observer of the light is considered to be moving or not. Take the case of a moving vessel again. Having already established that light does not behave like a shell being fired from a gun, we might expect it to behave like the ripples on the water. If the observer were now someone aboard a moving boat, the wave front would appear to move ahead of the boat more slowly than the wave front going to the rear, because of the motion of the boat and of himself relative to the water. If light were a wave moving through a medium pervading all of space, a medium provisionally called the ether, then, with the Earth plowing its way through the ether, we ought to find the speed of light relative to us observers traveling along with the Earth to be different in different directions. But in a famous experiment carried out by Michelson and Morley in 1887, the speed of light was found to be the same in all directions. Thus, the speed of light is independent of whether either the source or the observer is considered to be moving. So there we have it. 1. The principle of relativity, which states that the laws of nature are the same for all inertial frames of reference. 2. One of those laws allows us to work out the value of the speed of light in a vacuum, a value which is the same in all inertial frames, regardless of the velocity of the source or the observer. These two statements came to be known as the two postulates, or fundamental principles, of special relativity. These facts had been common knowledge among physicists for a long time. It required the genius of Einstein to spot that although each of the two statements made sense when you thought about them separately, they did not appear to make sense if you put the two ideas together. It seemed as though if the first of them was right, then the second must be wrong, or if the second was right, the first must be wrong. If both were right, which we appear to have established, then something very, very serious must be amiss. The fact that the speed of light is the same for all inertial observers, regardless of the motion of the source or observer, means that our usual way of adding and subtracting velocities is wrong. And if there is something wrong with our conception of velocity, which is simply distance divided by time, then that in turn implies there must be something wrong with our conception of space or time or both. What we are dealing with is not some peculiarity of light or electromagnetic radiation. Anything traveling at the same speed as that of light will have the same value for its speed for all inertial observers. What is crucial is the speed and the implications for the underlying space and time, not the fact that we happen to be dealing with light. Time dilation. To see what is amiss, imagine an astronaut in a high-speed spacecraft and a mission controller on the ground. They both have identical clocks. The astronaut is to carry out a simple experiment. On the floor of the craft, she is to fix a lamp which emits a pulse of light. The pulse travels directly upwards at right angles to the direction of motion of the craft. There, the pulse strikes a bullseye target fixed to the ceiling. Let us say that the height of the craft is 4 meters. With the light traveling at speed c, she finds that the time taken for this trip, t dash, as measured on her clock, is given by t dash equals 4 over c. Now, let's see what this looks like from the perspective of the mission controller. As the craft passes him overhead, he too observes the trip performed by the light pulse from the source to the target. According to his perspective, during the time taken for the pulse to arrive at the target will have moved forward from where it was when the pulse was emitted. For him, the path is not vertical, it slopes. The length of this sloping path will clearly be longer than it was from the astronaut's point of view. Let us say that the craft moves forward 3 meters in the time it takes for the light pulse to travel from the source to the target. Using Pythagoras' theorem, where 3 squared plus 4 squared equals 5 squared, we see that the distance traveled by the pulse to get to the target is, according to the controller, 5 meters. So what does he find for the time taken for the pulse to perform the trip? Clearly, it is the distance traveled, 5 meters, divided by the speed at which he sees the light traveling. This, we have established, is c, the same as it was for the astronaut. Thus, for the controller, the time taken, t, registered on his clock, is given by t equals 5 over c. But this is not the time the astronaut found. She measured the time to be t dash equals 4 over c. So they disagree as to how long it took the pulse to perform the trip. According to the controller, the reading on the astronaut's clock is too low. Her clock is going slower than his. And it is not just the clock. Everything going on in the spacecraft is slowed down in the same ratio. If this were not so, the astronaut would be able to note that her clock was going slow, compared, say, to her heartbeat rate, or the time taken to boil a kettle, etc. And that, in turn, would allow her to deduce that she was moving, her speed somehow affecting the mechanism of the clock. But that is not allowed by the principle of relativity. All uniform motion is relative. Life for the astronaut must proceed in exactly the same way as it does for the mission controller. Thus, we conclude that everything happening in the spacecraft, the clock, the workings of the electronics, the astronaut's aging processes, her thinking processes, all are slowed down in the same ratio. When she observes her slow clock with her slow brain, nothing will seem amiss. Indeed, as far as she is concerned, everything inside the craft keeps in step and appears normal. It is only according to the controller that everything in the craft is slowed down. This is time dilation. The astronaut has her time. The controller has his. They are not the same. In that example, we took a specific case, one in which the astronaut and spacecraft traveled 3 meters in the time it takes light to travel the 5 meters from the source to the target. In other words, the craft is traveling at a speed of 3/5 c, that is, 0.6 c. And for that particular speed, we found that the astronaut's time was slowed down by a factor 4/5, that is, 0.8. It is easy enough to obtain a formula for any chosen speed, v. We apply Pythagoras' theorem to triangle ABC. The distances are as shown in figure 4. Thus, AC squared equals AB squared plus BC squared. AB squared equals AC squared minus BC squared. C squared T dash squared equals C squared minus V squared, all multiplied by T squared. T dash squared equals 1 minus V squared over C squared, all multiplied by T squared. T dash equals T multiplied by the square root of 1 minus V squared over C squared. From this formula, we see that if V is small compared to C, the expression under the square root sign approximates to 1, and T dash is approximately T. Yet no matter how small V becomes, the dilation effect is still there. This means that, strictly speaking, whenever we undertake a journey, say a bus trip, on alighting we ought to readjust our watch to get it back into synchronization with all the stationary clocks and watches. The reason we do not is that the effect is so small. For instance, someone opting to drive express trains all their working life will get out of step with those following sedentary jobs by no more than about 1/1,000,000th of a second by the time they retire. Hardly worth bothering about. At the other extreme, we see from the formula that as V approaches C, the expression under the square root sign approaches zero, and T dash tends to zero. In other words, time for the astronaut would effectively come to a standstill. This implies that if astronauts were capable of flying very close to the speed of light, they would hardly age at all and would, in effect, live forever. The downside, of course, is that their brains would have almost come to a standstill, which in turn means they would be unaware of having discovered the secret of eternal youth. So much for the theory. But is it true in practice? Emphatically, yes. In 1977, for instance, an experiment was carried out at the CERN laboratory in Geneva on subatomic particles called muons. These tiny particles are unstable, and after an average time of 2.2 multiplied by 10 to the power of minus 6 seconds, that is, 2.2 millionths of a second, they break up into smaller particles. They were made to travel repeatedly around a circular trajectory of about 14 meters diameter at a speed of v equals 0.9994c. The average lifetime of these moving muons was measured to be 29.3 times longer than that of stationary muons. Exactly the result expected from the formula we have derived to an experimental accuracy of 1 part in 2000. In a separate experiment carried out in 1971, the formula was checked out at aircraft speeds using identical atomic clocks, one carried in an aircraft and the other on the ground. Again, good agreement with theory was found. These and innumerable other experiments all confirm the correctness of the time dilation formula. The twin paradox. We have seen how the mission controller sees time passing slowly in the moving spacecraft, while the astronaut regards her time as normal. How does the astronaut see the mission controller's time? At first, one might think that if her time is going slow, then when she observes what is happening on the ground, she will perceive time down there to be going fast. But wait, that cannot be right. If it were, then we would immediately be able to conclude who was actually moving and who was stationary. We would have established that the astronaut was the moving observer because her time was affected by the motion, whereas the controller's wasn't. But that violates the principle of relativity. That is, that for inertial frames, all motion is relative. Thus, the principle leads us to the admittedly somewhat uncomfortable conclusion that if the controller concludes that the astronaut's clock is going slower than his, then she will conclude that his clock is going slower than hers. But how, you might ask, is that possible? How can we have two clocks, both of which are lagging behind the other? A preliminary to addressing this problem is that we must first recognize that in the setup we have described, we are not comparing clocks directly side by side. Though the astronaut and controller might indeed have synchronized their two clocks, as they were momentarily alongside each other at the start of the space trip, they cannot do the same for the subsequent reading. The spacecraft and its clock have flown off into the distance. The controller can only find out how the astronaut's clock is doing by waiting for some kind of signal, perhaps a light signal, to be emitted by her clock and received by himself. He then has to allow for the fact that it has taken time for that signal to travel from the craft's new location to himself at mission control. By adding that transmission time to the reading of the clock when it emitted the signal, he can then calculate what the time is on the other clock now and compare it with the reading on his own. It is only then that he concludes that the astronaut's clock is running slow. But note, this is the result of a calculation, not a direct visual comparison. And the same will be true for the astronaut. She arrives at her conclusion that it is the controller's clock that is running slow only on the basis of a calculation using a signal emitted by his clock. Which doubtless still leaves a nagging question in your mind, namely, but whose clock is really going slow? With the setup we have described, that is a meaningless question. It has no answer. As far as the mission controller is concerned, it is true that the astronaut's clock is the one going slow. As far as the astronaut is concerned, it is true that it is the mission controller's clock that is going slow. And we have to leave it at that. Not that people have left it at that. Enter the famous twin paradox. This proposal recognizes that the seemingly contradictory conclusions arise because the times are being calculated. But what if the calculations could be replaced by direct side-by-side comparisons of the two clocks, at the end of the journey as well as at the beginning? That way there would be no ambiguity. What this would require is that the spacecraft, having traveled to, say, a distant planet, turns around and comes back home, so that the two clocks can be compared directly. In the original formulation of the paradox, it was envisaged that there were twins, one who underwent this return journey and the other who didn't. On the traveler's return, one can't have both twins younger than each other, so which one really has now aged more than the other, or are they still both the same age? The experimental answer is provided by the experiment we mentioned earlier involving the muons traveling repeatedly round the circular path. These muons are playing the part of the astronaut. They start out from a particular point in the laboratory, perform a circuit, and return to the starting point. And it is these traveling muons that age less than an equivalent bunch of muons that remain at a single location in the laboratory. So this demonstrated that it is the astronauts' clock which will be lagging behind the mission controllers when they are directly compared for the second time. So, does this mean that we have violated the principle of relativity and revealed which observer is really moving, and consequently which clock is really slowed down by that motion? No. And the reason for that is that the principle applies only to inertial observers. The astronaut was in an inertial frame of reference while cruising at steady speed to the distant planet. And again, on the return journey, while cruising at steady speed. But, and it is a big but, in order to reverse the direction of the spacecraft at the turnaround point, the rockets had to be fired, loose objects lying on a table would have rolled off, the astronaut would be pressed into the seat, and so on. In other words, for the duration of the firing of the rockets, the craft was no longer an inertial reference frame. Newton's law of inertia did not apply. Only one observer remained in an inertial frame the whole time, and that was the mission controller. Only the mission controller is justified in applying the time dilation formula throughout. So if he concludes that the astronaut's clock runs slow, then that will be what one finds when the clocks are directly compared. Because of that period of acceleration undergone by the astronaut, the symmetry between the two observers is broken and the paradox resolved. At least, it is partially resolved. The astronaut knows that she has violated the condition of remaining in an inertial frame throughout, and so has to accept that she cannot automatically and blindly use the time dilation formula in the way that the mission controller is justified in doing. But it still leaves her with a puzzle. During the steady cruise out, she is able, from her calculations, to conclude that the controller's clock was going slower than her own. During the steady cruise home, she can conclude that the controller's clock will be losing even more time compared to her own, the time dilation effect not being dependent on the direction of motion, only on the moving clock's speed relative to the observer. That being so, how on earth, literally, did the mission controller's clock get ahead of her own? What was responsible for that? Is there any way the astronaut could calculate in advance that the controller's clock would be ahead of hers by the end of the return journey? The answer is yes, there is. But we shall have to reserve the complete resolution of the twin paradox for later, when we have had a chance to see what effect acceleration has on time. Length contraction. Imagine the spacecraft traveling to a distant planet. Knowing both the speed of the craft, V, and the distance, S, from the Earth to that planet, the mission controller can work out how long the journey should take as recorded on his clock. He finds T equals S over U. The astronaut can do the same kind of calculation. But we already know that her time, T dash, will not be the same as the controller's because of time dilation. So won't she find that she has arrived too soon? That she couldn't possibly have covered a distance, S, at speed V, in the reduced time, T dash? That would allow her to conclude that it must be she who is really moving. This would again violate the principle of relativity. Something is clearly wrong. But what? It cannot be the speed, V. Both observers are agreed as to their relative speed. No, the resolution of the dilemma lies with their respective estimates of the distance from the Earth to the planet. Just as the controller has his time, T, and the astronaut has hers, T dash, he has his estimate of the distance, S, and she has hers, S dash. How do they differ? In the same ratio as the times differed. For the astronaut, S dash equals VT dash. S dash equals VT multiplied by the square root of 1 minus V squared over C squared. But for the controller, S equals V.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?